Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 11th of July, 2017. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, Patrick Henningsen, once again. Thanks for joining me, Pat.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, Brexit. We're going to get straight on with Brexit because, of course, Theresa May is relaunching her leadership today.
Exciting.
It's exciting. She's going to make a huge speech. Here's what she's going to say. She's going to say, at this critical time in our history, we can either be timid or we can be bold.
So she's hired a new speech writer. This is good.
This is good. She goes on to say, in everything we do, we will act with an unshakable sense of purpose to build the better, fairer Britain that we all want to see. Mm-hmm. Do you think the people of Grenfell Tower would agree with that?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. And she says, so please, Jeremy, please, let's form a government of national unity. Please, please.
She didn't really say that, did she?
No, she didn't. But that, and she hasn't said any of it yet. But
okay.
the first couple of sections are certainly how she's being quoted.
So
that she will
clearly
say,
going for a government of national unity. That seems to be the path forward.
It is, because she recognises that she's absolutely in trouble. Now, of course, what she's going to do, and I'm not sure whether it's part of this speech or not, is she's going to publish the Great Reform Bill, which is no longer called the Great Reform Bill.
It's been rebranded.
Repeal Bill, I do apologise. Great Repeal Bill. It's now been rebranded. It's just the Repeal Bill. And of course, nothing is getting repealed except for the one Act of Parliament, which is the European Communities Act 1972. So that's going to get repealed. But the rest is not about repeal. In fact, it's about the Acquis Communautaire, which is the entire body of EU legislation, which is going to be transposed into British domestic legislation. That's what the Great Repeal Bill is, in typical Theresa May style, giving it a name which is 180 degrees out from reality.
A lot of rebranding going on this week.
Absolutely. And her concern, her main concern, is that she's not going to get support for the Great Repeal Bill. There are going to be a huge number of amendments. We got a hint this week, I can't remember whose newsletter it was, Patrick, you can remind me, that it's going to get its first reading this week, but not its second reading, perhaps for as much as 6 months.
Second reading, doubtfully, maybe not in September, maybe in December.
Yeah.
Not only that, but there's talk also, and I think this is worth noting, that quite a lot of the legislation coming under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights, this could be still on the books and active as European legislation for up to possibly more than 5 years. This is part of the 5-year plan as well that we're looking at. And that's just an indication, Mike, of how long this process could stretch out.
Okay, and the point here is that she is extremely uncertain in her position. She's certainly not in a strong and stable position, which is what she was promoting before the general election. Of course, there are the Remainers within her own party that are clearly going to stir up trouble. So many of the mainstream papers today suggesting dirty tricks, dark conspiracies was one quote I saw. So this seems to once again be exactly what we forecast, just chaos around the issue of Brexit and no progress.
Amongst the Tory MPs in Parliament, there's already this term, Mike, called Brexit backslider. This is now being used, sort of bandied around in Parliament. And reversers, this is another term, reversers, this is within the Conservative Party. So you can already see the sort of scenes being set, Mike, for these sort of what looks like maybe the eventual gradual letdown of the previously staunch, hard position of we're going to have a hard Brexit, then soon it's going to be a soft Brexit, and then very soon after that, no Brexit whatsoever.
And more people saying exactly that, no Brexit whatsoever. Okay, well, let's move on to Grenfell then, because Grenfell Tower continues to throw up surprises. And in this case, the police now saying that they have concluded certain investigations and decided that based on those investigations, there were probably maybe 350 people in the tower and not the 500 to 650 that other people had been, and you know, we had suggested 650 based on local comments and also based on other documentation. So there, police have confirmed 255 people escaped the blaze. They say that investigations have led them to conclude. This is not a definitive answer, Patrick, still. Investigations have led them to conclude 350 people living in the tower, that 14 of them were not there when the building went up in flames. So they're suggesting that the current estimate of something around 80, again, they're still not prepared to put a definitive figure on it, but something like 80 people is going to be the final death toll. And they're making the statement that those 80 deaths potentially resulted from manslaughter. So this is where they're going with it. But in the meantime, Patrick, as I pointed this article out on the Sunday Wire on Sunday evening, this in The Guardian, Grenfell survivors blame mainstream media. How do we overcome mistrust is the headline. This is a spectacular article. It begins with a quote. It says, "If I had my way," said one passionately furious West Londoner recently, "I wouldn't be out here talking. You would be the first person I would be seizing, you, the media." This is Mr. Blagrove, the coordinator of Justice for Grenfell, who was responding to a Sky News colleague of the journalist here, Jason Farrell, who was trying to get him to do an on-camera interview. Blagrove wouldn't do the interview, but his anti-mainstream media tirade was filmed by others nearby instead and posted on social media. Really, the question being asked by The Guardian, how do we overcome the mistrust? Now, it seems to me, Patrick, that the first way that the media might overcome the mistrust might be to not just accept the details that are coming from the police and from the government, and perhaps actually try to establish the truth of the situation. And the mainstream media not doing that yet still. They're just simply regurgitating what they're being told without asking any questions.
So it's The Guardian running a story by Afua Hirsch. How can we overcome this mistrust that the public seems to have in us? And if you go back to two slides previous, and you look at the Grenfell story with the police numbers, police talking about 350 residents in the building, and The Guardian put that in their article, and not just The Guardian, but any of the other mainstream publications, there's no challenge to what government or the police are saying in their statements. In other words, they're just stenographers for the government. This is what the mainstream press have become. They're not challenging that at all. This is like nothing to see here. Let's move along, off to the next, waiting for the next statement, official statement from the police or from the government. And that's not good enough for the press, because that's not what any of the residents are saying. So at least the media has the minimum obligation, based on how many residents and what the public mood is on this issue of how many deaths there are. They have the minimum obligation to investigate that, Mike. And they're not doing it. And they're not doing it intentionally, because this isn't like there's a lack of journalists or reporters on the payroll at any of these newspapers. They have plenty of them. They could send one person out to investigate this, and they haven't.
So we have the situation where Grenfell Tower's residents were not listened to with regard to the fire safety issue in the run-up to this event. And now that the event has taken place, Grenfell Tower residents and the local community not being listened to when they say that there are more than 80 people have died in this event. And indeed, the fire service personnel and police personnel that have spoken to us and others off the record, they are not being listened to. In fact, they're being censored. What is the statement that's been made here? The statement is, our investigations lead us to believe. This is not a definitive answer.
No, this is the biggest domestic story, Mike. The biggest domestic disaster post-World War II, right? And so all of these newspapers, The Guardian, The Independent, the Times, The Mail, The Mirror, The Sun, all of these newspapers, not between all of those, We don't have anybody investigating, really, really seriously investigating the number of deaths. Okay, that's simply not good enough. And in that sense, the fourth estate is totally useless if all they're going to do is sit there and wait at the podium, at the steps of the podium, for the official announcement to come, take the notes, put it down, walk away, wait for the next one. It's not good enough.
Absolutely. So if mainstream media, journalists and so on, are feeling nervous about dealing with local communities, what about death threats and physical abuse and living under police protection for Tory MPs?
Mm. So death threats. This is in the Telegraph. This was a story that I think it was printed on Sunday. It's the Sunday Telegraph. So Tory MPs apparently suffering all sorts of abuse and death threats, were told in this article. And it's a shocking reality of my life on the campaign trail as a Tory MP. This is just one particular story in here. But I thought it was interesting that this is the Telegraph taking a absolutely a partisan editorial line here, you know, as if Tory MPs are the only ones really under the gun with regards to what the public feel about politicians. Is simply not true. If they just have to put themselves in Tony Blair's shoes. I mean, if someone put up money for a bounty, really, to arrest Tony Blair.
I mean, so that's 2010.
That's 2010, yeah. So he's been in hiding, really, overseas for, and this is the former prime minister, he's new Labour leader. And so to say that this is just a Tory issue, Mike, I think is really disingenuous at best.
So, I mean, Pat, what do you think is at the heart of the thinking of the average journalist or the average MP that they claim to not understand why the public mood is as it is?
Well, you just really, and we'll go back to the previous statement we just made, look at the Grenfell Tower story. Why are the public so upset? Why are they distrustful? Is it because they're naturally skeptical, or they're paranoid, schizophrenic conspiracy theorists? Or is there some actual justification for those feelings? Is it based on a pattern of behavior? Is it based on being out of a political bureaucratic elite that seems to be out of touch? That's the way the public is perceiving their elected representatives and their bureaucracy. And there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why Grenfell Tower disaster happened. And it wasn't the fault of the people living in those buildings. Mm. And those are all the people that have these feelings about government and about the mainstream media. And so what we see is the media, the Telegraph, closing ranks with the political elites, blaming the public for this threat that the media and the politicians feel they have against the public. And one day, Mike, you won't even be able to see your MPs. You'll just be able to see them on the internet. And you'll never actually be able to see them face to face because they'll think it's just not safe enough.
I think that is exactly where we're going. Okay, well, of course, one of the things that Theresa May has announced is that she's going to be focusing on employees' rights. And this was Rebecca Long-Bailey on the Radio 4 Today programme this morning, really commenting on Uber, but more generally on the gig economy as it is. Now, Theresa May has said that she's going to aim for the national minimum wage for people that are employed in this way, sick pay as well, but that this isn't going to be a wholesale removal of zero hours contracts as such. So, you know, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, this is where the press and, you know, invariably where the BBC will ultimately take any of these arguments. We've listened to quite a few of these broadcasts on this very subject over the last week, and it always comes into workers' rights, workers' rights. Well, you know, they'll say, she says, I won't ride Uber, Rebecca Long-Bailey, because it's not morally acceptable, okay? look, people get a job with Uber because they want to top up their income, because the price of living in Britain is too high, because their heating bill is ridiculously high, because they need to pay the heating bill of their nan, because it's ridiculously high and the pension is ridiculously low. What the government is doing to pensioners, what the privatized gas companies and utilities, by gouging the public, that is immoral. That is the reason why people go and drive for Uber. Mm. Okay, so if you want to make it a moral argument, let's extend that a little bit further. But let's look at this would be a good argument if it was more intelligible, Mike, because what are we talking about here? Uber has created a system, a framework, a technology whereby people can work when they want to work and make money when they want to make money. And they're doing piecework, okay? It's not by the hour. And taxi drivers know they have to sit in their car, Mike, and they won't get a fare. They're not going to be paid for that time, okay? So this is a different type of job. So it has nothing to do with workers' rights. In fact, most people that work for Uber are there for a reason. If not, they can work for hundreds of other minicab firms. So, because there really is a technological argument or an argument based around technological progress. Okay, we wouldn't be having this argument if someone from Uber didn't invent this proprietary system, okay, which has created a lot of jobs for a lot of people around the planet. Now, if you don't like being tracked or having taxis being automated, that's a more intelligent argument that maybe Rebecca Long Bailey could have about having a taxi system that's not tracking your every move or that's not automatizing the whole taxi industry, because let me tell you, there will not be drivers behind the Uber cabs in a few years. They are pushing for driverless cars, and they're already testing it. It's already working in America now. There are driverless cars in America in different pilot cities. So let's get with the times, Rebecca Long Bailey. Let's have the real debate about Uber, because you seem to be pigeonholing it into a left-right socialist argument about workers' rights. It's a much, much bigger discussion, Mike.
And even the broader discussion on jobs itself, it just doesn't cease to amaze me how the government trots out their job statistics every year, and in the United States as well, all these new jobs that are created, and nobody in the mainstream media ever asks what kind of jobs are being created, what is our economy based on. And, so everything you say, I totally agree with. But when are we going to start asking, where are the productive, high-quality jobs?
Well, last year at the Bilderberg meeting, if you looked at the agenda, they talked a lot about the precariat class. This is what people like Peter Thiel are kind of on the cutting edge. One of the founders of Twitter, et cetera, the PayPal, they're on the cutting edge of this precariat class. So they've identified even Bilderberg. They know where these trends are heading, and they're investing behind these trends, behind the Ubers, behind some of these applications. Deliveroo is another one that'll be bought out by Uber probably within a few years. That'll become absorbed into Uber deliveries probably. But this idea of jobs, it's changing. The whole concept of employment is changing. But you know what? The cost of living just keeps going up. So we're going to have a massive crisis, Mike. Jobs just simply cannot meet the demand of the gouging which is going on by utility companies and every other sort of day-to-day expense, from rent to taxation, and it's just people cannot keep up.
Okay, well, let's move on to sovereignty and where sovereignty lies. Patrick, because you've posted a comment on 21st Century War over the issue that was, I think you've chosen the Daily Mail's article here to comment on, but armed US immigration officers to be stationed in UK airports.
Extraordinary as it may sound, this is actually being proposed right now as we speak. Every mainstream outlet, or at least newspaper, ran this story 2 days ago. We just chose the Daily Mail's here. But so what they're doing is they're proposing this to roll this scheme out at a couple of smaller airports. I think Manchester and Edinburgh would be the sort of pilot scheme. Now, the United States has already done this, and with Shannon Airport, I think, in Ireland, and another Irish airport. But so the idea behind this is that they sell this to decrease waiting time in immigration queues for people traveling to the United States. So my question is, and this is, again, this is another media issue, of all of these mainstream articles, Mike, not one of these papers questioned why U.S. immigration officers have to be armed in U.K. airports. I did not see that question. So what that tells me is this came off the conveyor belt of press releases from the government or the U.S. Embassy or whatever, and nobody questioned it. They copied it, pasted it, and it ran as a feature story. So we've asked the question at 21st Century Wire, why do these U.S. officers need to be armed? Because we already have British armed police at airports now. So why should the U.S. be? And so a lot of interesting comments have been raised on social media. I don't want to get into it, but I think the underwear bomber was mentioned. So right. I'll let you pursue that in your own time.
Okay, well, Donald Trump, your president, is due to set for a state visit next year. It was interesting that certain MPs, pretty unhappy about this, Crispin Blunt, for example, well, in the Commons this morning, they were talking about the anniversary of the Pilgrim Fathers heading over to the United States and how we were going to celebrate that. And Crispin Blunt suggested, well, perhaps we could put back Donald Trump's state visit so that it coincides with the anniversary in 2020. So clearly some MPs are pretty unhappy that Donald Trump is coming. There's still debate about whether he's going to be allowed to speak in Parliament. It sounds like probably not. So the hysteria amongst the elites continues.
Well, if they're going to allow the U.S. to have armed officers in British airports, why not let Donald Trump over? I mean, he was over every 2 weeks before he was president, and all of a sudden he's not allowed to come to the U.K. now. So I think there's a lot of people that don't want Trump over here for political reasons. But it could radically trigger some kind of massive shift, because everywhere this guy goes, the chessboards, because of the weight, the chessboard seems to distort a little bit. We saw what happened at the G20.
Yeah.
It completely overshadowed everything else compared to past meetings like that. It was just totally different narrative. It was power politics. It was really about where the real power lies and where the real issues are internationally.
Okay, well, as we mentioned last week, well, last week was the week of Ukrainian conferences, three Ukrainian conferences, including one at Chatham House, one at the sponsored by the Foreign Office. Well, Jens Stoltenberg in Kiev yesterday and the day before. What was he doing there? Well, apparently he has reaffirmed NATO's strong political and practical support for Ukraine. He said that, or he chaired a meeting of the NATO UK Commission, which was hosted by Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, he thanked Ukraine for its many contributions to NATO missions over the past two decades. So this is kind of important, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, the Ukraine is still an issue that is shrouded in disinformation. And the narrative has completely been distorted in terms of what really happened from 2014 onwards. And so we still have politicians that are parroting this kind of fictional history of what happened in February of 2014 and then in the run-up to that and after that. So they're still trying to base policy. This is an amazing move here by Mr. Stoltenberg. Claiming that Russia still has thousands of troops stationed in the Ukraine somehow.
Well, exactly. So as you can see there, he's really keen for a sovereign, independent, stable Ukraine. So let's have a look at some of the things he said. He said, we've just discussed the situation in eastern Ukraine. The conflict continues to claim lives. The fighting has killed more than 10,000 people, including almost 3,000 civilians. It's clear that the ceasefire is not holding, and we're concerned by increasing threats against OSCE monitors. The Minsk agreements remain the only path towards peace. Russia must withdraw its thousands of soldiers from Ukraine and stop supporting the militants with command and control and military equipment. Which thousands of soldiers are those?
Well, I think Jan Stoltenberg here from Norway is conspiracy theorizing, as everybody seems to be doing in Washington as well on this issue and in London and around Europe. So thousands of Russian troops in the Ukraine. Is he talking about in eastern Ukraine? Is he talking about the Crimea? It's unclear. And I think there's a lot of people that are using this unclarity in order to sort of push disinformation out to the public. Russia has stationed at their Black Sea Fleet naval base around Sevastopol, 26,000 Russian troops long before the crisis took place in the Ukraine. In fact, that has been Russia's main naval base, Mike, since the time of Catherine the Great in the late 1700s. Mm. So to suggest that somehow Russia's occupying the Crimea or occupying the Ukraine is not true. And this is the head of NATO. This is amazing.
Absolutely. So let's look at what else he had to say. Russia must withdraw its thousands of soldiers from Ukraine and stop supporting the militants with command and control of military equipment. NATO stands firm in our support for Ukraine's sovereign sovereignty and territorial integrity. We do not and we will not recognize Russia's illegal and illegitimate annexation of Crimea.
Well, that's an interesting term, annexation. And you hear that pushed around a lot by Western anti-Russian politicians. And the fact of the matter is, Mike, that Crimea was only a part of the Ukraine, I believe, since the mid-1950s. So in effect, Russia reunified with Crimea, because before that, it was part of Russia proper. And so if it's just a, that one word makes a big difference. You could say the same thing. Eastern Europe, or East Germany, was separated from Germany for a period of time, similar time frame, and then it was reunified with West Germany. West Germany didn't annex East Germany, so certainly one could even take that line of approach when looking at this issue. They did have a referendum, by the way. I know it's not recognized by the West, but I think 90%+ of the people in Crimea voted that they didn't want any have anything to do with the coup and the military junta in Kiev, and so they voted to join the Russian Federation, which is kind of a no-brainer considering what was going on at the time. So, you know, is that democratic process worth anything? Is that referendum 90%+? Is that a mandate?
90%.
I don't know if it's good enough for the EU. Maybe not.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's mention Mosul again, because we mentioned this yesterday. Mosul was announced to have been liberated, and if you remember, we pointed out that Michael Fallon had said this, that he congratulated Prime Minister Abadi and the Iraqi forces who had been fighting on the ground with great bravery and care against a brutal opponent, and we were really pointing the hypocrisy. At the hypocrisy of Michael Fallon, because of course he didn't make any such congratulations to Bashar al-Assad. In fact, quite the opposite. He criticized the Russians and the Syrians up very heavily for the civilian implications of the action in East Aleppo. So I just thought we would have a look at what the situation for civilians in Mosul is. And I'm sorry we have to use Amnesty for this, but they have produced the statistics. They say the civilian catastrophe, more than 600,000 people affected by it, 5,805 civilians injured and so killed and so on. The Mosul operation had a huge toll on civilians, and this was mostly ignored by the mainstream media in Mosul because it didn't fit with the narrative of the criticism of Assad over over Aleppo. And the other thing, let's criticize Amnesty just a little bit, because the sort of header image that they have on this page, the page is useful, but nonetheless, at any cost, is the headline, the civilian catastrophe in West Mosul, Iraq, because really it has been at any cost, and Amnesty hasn't really been focusing on this issue, and hasn't been focusing on how this situation arose in the first place, Patrick.
Well, it seems a little more sort of acceptable politically because Obama is no longer president. So for the left, liberal left-wing organization like Amnesty International, Donald Trump is president. So it's a little bit, you know, they have a little bit more sort of leverage or incentive politically maybe to go with that. But what Amnesty is not showing you, if you go back, this is interesting. Look at the wording here, at any cost, civilian catastrophe in West Mosul. So they've already basically divided Mosul into East and West. So they've delineated the difference between East and West Mosul. They never did this for 3 years in Aleppo. What they didn't say East Aleppo, West Aleppo. They said Aleppo was under siege. Not just Amnesty, but you know the whole Human Rights Watch, the whole of the mainstream media. So all of a sudden they've found their compass and they're able to read battle maps now. And so they've segregated West and East Mosul. So the militants using the civilians as human shields, ISIS, in West Mosul. This is exactly what the terrorists were doing in East Aleppo before that. And so the Amnesty would never separate the militants from the humans as well. If you look at the go back to the death figures, Mike.
Yeah.
Go back to the casualty figures. So look at that, 5,805. This is civilians may have been killed during this time frame in the retaking of Mosul.
Yeah, that was just from February to June this year.
From ISIS, right. So, and as a result, we also have, as a result of attacks by Iraqi and U.S.-led coalition forces. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Mike. I'm going to say that the actual numbers, if you discount militants, the actual numbers in Mosul might be worse than Aleppo. So what the U.S.-led coalition did in Mosul killed more civilians, possibly, than what the Syrian army and the Russians did in Aleppo. Because you have to remember, there were much more al-Nusra fighters, Ahrar al-Sham, and a host of terrorist fighters in East Aleppo. The numbers, I think, were far greater on the aggregate than ISIS fighters who are occupying this part of Mosul, which was contested recently.
Okay, so Michael Fallon and also Priti Patel not willing to make any concessions with regard to what happened to Aleppo, but the Russians prepared to make a positive comment with regard to Mosul. So the Russian Foreign Ministry issued this statement yesterday evening. They said the capture of Mosul was accomplished thanks to the courage and perseverance of the Iraqi soldiers, the People's Militia, and the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. Yet it should be noted that a high price was paid in the offensive to recapture Mosul. And they then went on to talk about the civilian casualty statistics, which aren't so dissimilar from those published by Amnesty, although they don't cite Amnesty as a source. The foreign ministry went on to say, Moscow supports the actions by the Iraqi authorities aimed at restoring the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. We are certain that promoting intra-Iraqi national reconciliation with due account of the interests of all ethnic and religious groups will consolidate the progress in fighting terrorism. So a relatively positive response from the Russians to a conflict that they're not directly involved in. It's just a shame, Patrick, that that Britain, the United States, couldn't be of a similar mind with regard to Syria.
What's interesting is the Russians will give credit to the Iraqi special forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga, so they're giving credit to the natives, the Russians, whereas if you watch U.S. media over the last 3 weeks, it's all about the U.S. military, it's all about the coalition, and it's just an afterthought, the Iraqis and the Kurds, so they don't really want to give too much credit to the natives. It's all about building up the profile of the U.S. military. That's really what the media in the U.S. has been doing throughout the process of this whole coverage of Mosul.
Now, I want to give a heads up once again to Robert Stewart and his website, Fabrication and BBC Panorama, Saving Syria's Children. This, if you remember, was the absolutely seminal documentary in 2013 where the BBC were apparently covering what they were describing as a napalm-like incident where napalm or some other substance similar to that was dropped on a school with children. The timing of this was extremely important because it came on the same day that the House of Commons was voting on whether we were going to bomb Syria or not. Many, many questions to be answered on this documentary. Robert has posted a new article, BBC Panorama team embedded with an Islamic State partner group. And this is quite interesting, Patrick, because what he's saying is that scenes in the 2013 BBC Panorama special Saving Syria's Children reveal that the award-winning team of reporter Ian Pennell and cameraman Darren Conway were embedded with jihadi group Ahrar al-Sham, which, according to Human Rights Watch, had 3 weeks earlier worked alongside Islamic State and al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra as one of the key fundraisers, organisers, planners and executors of an attack that left 190 civilians dead. He highlights that within the documentary itself, we see shots like this. So this is the car that was driving Ian Pennell around. And the logo on the bonnet of the car is the logo that was used at the time by Ahrar al-Sham. Mm-hmm. Now, we know how these guys are rebranding themselves, so that brand has changed, but that's the logo that was used at the time. What he says is that on the morning of the 26th of August, in order, quotes, to see what medical care is available for children closer to where the fighting is, that the two doctors in the documentary were taken. Western journalists have been targeted in Syria, so I have to travel with my own security, he said. The doctors are able to be more low-key and take their own vehicles. So Pennell using his own security. So who was driving him? Well, these guys were driving him. Okay, so this is at the wheel of Pennell's convoy car in the documentary. One of the people credited here is a fixer slash translator, Mugira al-Sharif. And on the same day, Sharif posted this photograph to his Instagram account, because, you know, they all use social media of various kinds. The point that Robert's making is that these guys could very well have been involved in that event at Latakia 22 days earlier. We don't know.
The abduction of those children from that village.
This is 190 civilians killed in that in that event. So many questions continue to get new questions almost on a weekly basis. Robert is providing on this documentary, the BBC refusing to give any further information. And we've got to keep pressure on with it, because this was a key piece of propaganda that the BBC put out in 2013. If they're prepared to do it then, they'll do it at any time. So we've got to get some answers to this.
So technically, we could say that did the BBC pay their driver and fixer? I'm sure they did. They did it for free.
No.
Let's just say maybe they did. But likely, in all likelihood, Mike, they paid the driver and the fixer. They paid those two gentlemen there. So if they're members, or any of them are members of Ahrar al-Sham, that means the BBC handed cash over to a terrorist group. Mm. Basically, and they could say, well, we didn't know they were a terrorist group at the time. We thought they were moderate rebels. Well, this just speaks to the sort of total ignorance, the general ignorance of the media about the Syrian conflict from day one. This fabricated fantasy that somehow these were moderate rebel groups, and this was all part of the Arab Spring and the revolution and so forth. And so the mainstream media propagated this myth. Okay, so maybe they didn't know, Mike, but it is a fact. Ahrar al-Sham is a violent terrorist group, and I might add, they fall under the control, and this has been proven many times by many journalists and analysts already, that Ahrar al-Sham falls under the control of Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. So that's who the BBC were working with behind the scenes.
To produce this documentary.
You can spin it any way you want, but that's how the facts flesh out. So that's kind of a serious...
It's a very serious allegation.
Very serious thing.
One of many.
Certainly it should be looked into, I think. It should be discussed. You know, this film is amazing, Mike, the amount of stuff that it's dredging up. So
anybody that wants to find out more about this, if you get onto your search engine of choice and type in Robert Stewart and Saving Syria's Children, and you will find his website. Do have a look at it. There's a huge amount of information there. The BBC have a huge number of questions to answer, and I, for one, would be very keen to see more people asking those questions. Okay, Pat, we'll end on this one. Now, the thing about Syria, of course, is it is a secular state, and they absolutely have respect for each other's religion and so on. But it looks like perhaps Israel wanting to move more in that direction.
Well, no, yeah, it seems that way. So what a lot of people don't know, and this is more or less blacked out of the Western media, is the fact that Israel calls itself the Jewish state. So this is a religious-based state. And most people think, oh, that's an anathema for the 21st century. I mean, we've progressed past all that. But there's two countries in the Middle East, or entities, let's say, and some people might say don't recognize Israel. It's a fact. A lot of people don't in the Middle East don't recognize Israel as a country. It's a Zionist entity. This is what they would call it if they're from Syria, a lot of people. So Saudi Arabia and Israel are the only two religious states in the region, basically. They have so much in common on that level. So they've run a poll here. Let's go back to that. So over half of Israelis, okay, let me repeat that, over half of the population of Israel does not want to live in a Jewish state. They would like a separation of church and state, and this population's growing ever more diverse. So you have a radical minority, a radical Zionist minority, basically lording over the majority of the population. And so this is the root of a lot of problems, I think, in Israel. And this could be one of the things, if this is able to change, it could help to pave the way, possibly, for those who call themselves Israeli to actually recognize the basic human rights of the native Palestinian population. Because most Israelis are not from the Middle East, you see. They or their parents emigrated from Eastern Europe or from the United States or Canada or Australia or anywhere else in the world. So this is potentially an interesting
development
in Israel. And from a democratic point of view, or a progressive, if you call yourself a progressive, it's a positive development potentially. So it could be interesting.
Okay, thank you for that. We'll leave it there for today. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1 p.m. as usual. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.